To the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. I am Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
And Fred, you're also the webmaster for the esteemed Creation Research Society.
Yes, and today we're going to talk about really, really old spider webs.
Really old? How old are they? Oh, you're right. This is 140 million years ago, Fred. They found a spider web. And we're not making this up, right?
We're not making this up.
No, this is from the BBC.
Well, we might be making up the part about 140 million years, but,
yeah.
Well, but we're telling what people say how old it is.
Yeah, we're just repeating that part.
Yes.
National Geographic and the BBC have reported on, and by the way, we're going through Creation Magazine from September 2009. This is such a great magazine. It is so much fun. So, according to the BBC and National Geographic, two brothers found a spider web inside of amber, and the scientists have said that this is a web that was spun during the dinosaur era 140 million years ago, and that's a long time ago, Fred.
It is. And I guess there's some paleobiologist from Oxford University, and this guy, he showed that the amber resembles silk spun by modern spiders.
Whoa. Now, that's a surprise.
He was surprised.
He was surprised.
He was very surprised that it would stay the same for 140 million years.
Scientists expressed surprise that the spider webs have stayed the same for 140. That is surprising. I mean, couldn't they come up with a different pattern, Fred? Couldn't they weave words into their webs like wonderful and amazing, like that Charlotte's Web story that our kids enjoy? I mean, come on. These patterns have stayed the same for 140 million years. Darwinists would have thought, well, we're probably never going to find a spider web from 140 million years ago. But if we do, it would be so far removed evolutionarily from modern spider webs.
Well, they start with the assumption of evolution in millions of years. And because of that assumption, how many times, constantly, we see things where the scientists are saying, they are dumbfounded. They are surprised.
Surprise. I wish I had Andy Griffith's, you know that character on Andy Griffith? Gomer Pyle.
Oh, Gomer Pyle, yeah.
I wish I had him on the show to say, surprise, surprise, surprise. Surprise, surprise, surprise. They're always surprised at everything they find. Why don't they ever find things when they plow into a comet? Why don't they say, you know, we found exactly what we were expecting? They always say, we're going to have to rethink this whole comet thing. All right, so now, Fred, there are billboards on buses in England supported by that atheist evolutionist Richard Dawkins. And we actually talked about this earlier in 2009. The billboard says, there's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life.
Now, isn't probably a problem?
Probably turns out to be a problem.
They don't believe in their own unbelief.
Yeah. That's too funny. Either there is a God or there is no God. The word probably in their billboards, you know what they're helping us do? They're helping us get out the message that atheists do not have proof of their atheism. They hold to atheism by faith.
That's right. It's a religious belief system. It's clearly not based on any scientific evidence.
Yeah, and even Richard Dawkins has admitted this, that when an atheist says there's no God, he's taking a faith position. So at least some of the atheists, now there are a lot of atheists who can't get themselves to admit that obvious reality, but some do admit that, hey, we have faith too. We just have faith in something different. They have faith that despite all the evidence of design, there's no designer.
That's right. It's a blind faith. You talk about blind faith. I mean, that's it.
Yeah. So, Fred, one of the reasons I love Creation Magazine is because they're also on the cutting edge of all the moral issues. they point out the problems with homosexuality. And not only that it's a sin, but also that it's been a crime through the millennia. And they point out the problems with sex outside of marriage and abortion. Well, there's an article in here on stem cell research, and they are on the cutting edge over and over. Because as American Right to Life would point out, that killing any child for any reason is unconscionable. And it doesn't matter if killing one child would cure the whole world of disease. It doesn't matter. You don't kill the child. It's not a numbers game.
It's That's right. It's murder.
It's obeying God. Right. But there's an article in here about stem cell research, and they are showing that once again, extraordinary success with adult stem cells, whereas embryonic stem cells have been overwhelmingly problematic and lacking in success.
That's right. They often cause tumors and cancer. I mean, how many people know that in the audience that embryonic stem cells, they don't work?
Well, it's fraught with difficulty. But, you know, American Right to Life, Fred, frequently points out, even if it does work someday, that doesn't matter. But
That's
there's
right.
overwhelming success with adult stem cells where you don't have to kill anybody. You get adult stem cells from maybe even the adult who's ill and you're trying to cure the person, or another adult, or an umbilical cord. Those are considered adult stem cells. Or teeth. When your child's teeth fall out to be replaced by adult teeth, they are filled with stem cells, for example.
That's right. And, you know, adult stem cells, if they take them from your own body, your body's not going to reject them. That's one of the nice aspects of adult stem cells.
Yeah. So now, what did they do here? There's blindness, a certain kind of blindness having to do with the cornea when there's corneal damage. And researchers in Australia have invented a new way of treating this kind of corneal damage. What did they do?
Well, it's real interesting. They extracted stem cells from the same person's undamaged eye. Now, their other cornea, again, was damaged. They weren't completely blind, but they had a damaged cornea.
By blindness in one eye.
Yes. So they took adult stem cells,
the stem cells
from the other eye.
They basically, it's non-invasive. They sort of scraped cells off of the one orb, their other eye. And where did they put those stem cells? Do you remember?
Well, they put it on a contact lens.
This is astounding,
and they put it in the other, in the damaged eye. And those stem cells did their work.
They rebuilt the cornea. Fred, this shows the majesty of our creator God. God put the DNA, the genetic code to build an entire human body into virtually every cell in our body. The code is there. So they took stem cells. Imagine that. You're blind in one eye from cornea damage. So the researchers think, well, there's stem cells. Nowadays, they're almost everywhere. We don't have to kill babies to get stem cells.
That's right.
They scrape off stem cells from the good eye. They put it on the inside of a contact lens, and they say, here, put on this contact lens. The person puts on the contact lens, and in less than 2 weeks, they have a repaired cornea.
All three patients had the improved vision.
This is startling.
Well, it is. And, you know, we're making a lot of progress with adult stem cells. In fact, I've worked at a company where we built a bioreactor that grows adult stem cells because it's an expensive process. But the reason why they're funding this project is because of all the promise it's showing with the adult stem cells.
In fact,
we had a speaker, Bob, a couple of months ago at our Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship meeting that meets the second Friday of every month at Bethlehem Lutheran Church.
That's right.
And anyways, he's an expert in this field. And he said that adult stem cells are actually now showing what's called pluripotent capability. They can differentiate into other kinds of cells, which is supposed to be the promise of embryonic stem cells.
Right.
So he said that there's a leading researcher at Colorado University that said that embryonic stem cells should already be gone by now. There should be no more consideration of them because of the adult stem cells.
And I think we know, as creationists and pro-lifers, we probably have a better insight than the evolutionary microbiologist researchers who are working with embryonic stem cells. We could just say, with our somewhat superficial knowledge of the field, that a major reason why they're having such difficulty is because of the intensity of the embryonic fetal development activity going on with embryonic genes. We talked about Hox genes and these regulatory genes. Well, there is this explosion of regulatory activity in the development of the human embryo, the fetus, the little one, the baby. And so when you're dealing with embryonic genes, it's like trying to drive through a city like Manhattan where every street people are driving 120 miles an hour and there are no stop signs and no traffic lights, and you're trying to get across the island.
And again, often it leads to uncontrollable tumors and cancer. There's a poor patient in Israel they pumped full of embryonic stem cells and he grew tumors all over his body.
Yeah. So, you know, the media will be thrilled if they could point to long-term success of embryonic stem cell research. But again, it doesn't matter if you can cure the whole world by intentionally killing one child. You don't do it. It's not a numbers game. Satan would be glad, Fred, to end all abortion if only all pro-lifers would agree to aborting one child. If we'd all agree to just one more abortion, then he would be happy to end all abortion, because the goal is to get us to disobey God. That's the goal.
That's right.
It's not a numbers game. So, okay, another great article by Creation Magazine, this one on the curing of corneal damage from adult stem cells. It's just absolutely awesome what's happening.
Yeah, the next article that we have is viruses that help fight cancer. That's interesting. Aren't viruses supposed to be completely harmful and not creationists can't explain them?
Yeah, that's one of those are those germs things, viruses. Yeah. Give the you a swine flu and all, and AIDS.
Yeah, why would God create a bad thing like viruses?
Yeah, viruses in the original creation had helpful functions. They would not cause disease. But because of the fall, Adam and Eve rebelled against God, and we are part of the ecosystem of our world, in fact, our whole solar system. And so when Adam and Eve sinned, they died, leading to physical death, and that literally broke the ecosystem so that the animal and plant kingdoms also began to break down. And viruses have basically been a major source now of disease for the human race and for animals.
That's right. But we are now finding some of these beneficial features of viruses, and this article covers an example of a virus that apparently is preventing tumors. A Canadian firm, Oncolix Biotech, has made a new drug that is really not a drug. It's what they call a real virus.
What researchers are able to do is now sort of hijack bacteria, viruses, and use those as, well, sometimes vehicles to get into cells to deliver some really important treatment or medication. And this is just absolutely awesome that at Oncolytix Biotech in Canada, they're figuring out once again how to use the brain God gave us and how to use viruses to help people who have cancer. And in one of their clinical trials, they've shown tumors shrinking significantly. In one case, the tumor completely disappeared.
That's right. I mean, these viruses are like, I don't know if a repairman's a good analogy, but they're like sustainers. Mm. And I think that was their pre-fall function. And then with the fall, they mutated. A lot of these stopped doing the job they're supposed to. Mm-hmm. You know, the repairman started ripping you off.
Yeah, and like the evolutionists said our appendix is useless, and now they figure out that the appendix is a reservoir for good bacteria.
That's right.
If you get sick and the bacteria in your intestines are all wiped out, then you could resupply from your appendix.
Evolutionary thinking has led to a lot of bad science, and that includes, you talked about the appendix, but tonsils. How many people in the listening audience had their tonsils removed?
Unnecessarily.
Unnecessarily,
so.
And a lot of that was based on the faulty science of evolution and their belief that it was a leftover organ from, you know, that we no longer need. And we found out we do need it. I mean, there are reasons now to remove them, but they're the right reasons.
Sure. So, Fred, could we go from 140-million-year-old spider web and viruses to now dinosaurs? Okay, the dinosaurs that were alive when the 140-million-year-old spider was spinning its web. Fred, the dinosaurs, I grew up reading books about dinosaurs, fascinated like all young boys are with dinosaurs. And I remember the Brontosaurus. You remember the Brontosaurus?
I do, the Brontosaurus. And it's no longer a dinosaur.
It's no longer. You can't talk about a Brontosaurus because it just, it was wrong. The paleontologists didn't understand what they were looking at, and they said there's a Brontosaurus, and there's no Brontosaurus.
Yeah, they put the wrong head on the wrong body. It's a long story, but
it's
basically
it was a long neck story.
Yeah. Basically, it really was an Apatosaurus, which is a real dinosaur, but a Brontosaurus is only on Fred Flintstone.
So now it turns out that at the University of Bristol in England, paleontologist Michael Benton says, we've now researched all the scientifically named dinosaurs, and it turns out that when we've looked at actually 1,400 scientific names, Fred, for dinosaurs from 1824 to 2004, over 180 years, they find out that 50% of them embodied serious errors, duplications, Brontosaurus-type problems. And so when they really looked at 1,000 specimens, they ended up with only 500 dinosaurs out of 1,000.
So they were wrong by half the dinosaurs that they tried to, the paleontologists looked at these fossils and said, hey, it's this so-and-so dinosaur, but they misinterpreted it.
By half. And so what that tells me, of course, scientists make mistakes, but making mistakes by half? Fred, supposedly these evolutionists who are so professional and they issue their conclusions with such care and precision that they can never possibly be wrong on half of the dinosaurs. It reminds me of Donald Johanson finding a few bones for Lucy, Australopithecus, and he says, what, within 2 hours, this is a forerunner of Homo sapiens. And it's like, how did you know that?
It could have been worse. It could have been just a single tooth. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah, Nebraska man. They found a tooth on a farm in Nebraska, and they built the whole jaw and the skull and the spinal column and the whole skeleton.
Well, they built his wife, too.
They built his wife, his kids, how much hair he had on his body, the kinds of tools he used. They built it all, the social structure, and then they said, oops, we found the rest of the teeth. We found the rest of the skeleton. It wasn't Nebraska man. It was a pig.
It was a pig.
It was a pig. Yeah, so they took a tooth and they built an entire hominid, one of the evolutionary forerunners of man.
You know, there's a guy named Osborne that was the head of the American Museum of History, and he said, this tooth speaks volumes of man's ancestry.
Yeah, right.
How many times are these guys proven wrong? I mean, we talked about Ida not that long ago, I think a couple of months
ago.
Ida,
that funny
and
fossil.
That's, yeah, well, they, you know, these evolutionists keep trying to turn these ape bones into humans.
Yeah, in fact, you know what we need? We need a remake of that movie that the evolutionists in Hollywood love, Inherit the Wind. On the Scopes trial, remember that? Because I think the Nebraska man tooth, I think that was part of the media scam over the Scopes trial in 1925 in Tennessee about teaching evolution. But we do need a new movie about that case, Fred.
We do, and actually I've heard that there's one in the works, by the way.
Oh, that'll be exciting.
It will be.
All right. Okay, so anyway, the evolutionist, they make these errors because, as evolutionists themselves admit when they criticize others, they say, look, there's a quest for glory. There's a lust for headlines. They're looking for funding. So if you discover, like Johanson did, some Lucy bones, Australopithecus, it's a chimp that's about 3 feet tall, and you say, this is a forerunner to man, you get millions of dollars.
There's a quote that he said where he said he would lose, he needs to find a hominid and fast or his funding's going to dry up.
Yeah, exactly. So lo and behold, he finds one. And, you know, her inner ear, when they did the CAT scan, they said Lucy walked upright, except her inner ear is oriented like a chimp, not like an upright walking person. And how about her pelvic bone?
The pelvis is hilarious because the pelvis is shaped like it's a chimpanzee's pelvis.
Yeah.
And there was a science show. I don't know if you remember.
Was it Nova? I think it was Nova.
And there was a scientist who said, well, this thing was stepped on, and so it's really not the shape of a chimpanzee. So you see him on the show with his equipment.
Grinding,
sanding this thing down.
Lucy's pelvic bone.
He had a replica of the bone, and he was grinding it down to shape it more like a human pelvis. So they're creating evidence after the fact.
So that she could be an upright walker And they admit it. That's how bold they are. They just take her bone, and he said her bone was crushed when it was buried as a fossil, and so we have to fix it.
How can the producers of the show not realize how silly this is?
Well, they don't know that the tree of life was wrong, but now they should know that. And natural selection is being slaughtered by Evo Devo. So we're having fun, Fred.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So the dinosaurs, beware. The dinosaurs do tell a tall tale of paleontologists and evolutionists who are unreliable.
They have wild imaginations.
Yes. All right. So how about could we go from dinosaurs to galaxies?
Okay. Well, there's an article in here about oddly young galaxies. And in fact, we've talked about this before. You know, galaxies have these spiral arms, Bob.
Yes, spiral arms.
Spiral arms. And we know from Newton's laws that the stars in the center rotate faster than the stars on the arms. And over time, it should wind up like a clock screw and be a featureless disk.
They should deform because the stars in the spiral arms are not moving at the proper rates compared to the stars in the center of the spiral galaxies, and the spiral shape should just deform, and that's known by astrophysicists. They know that.
Yeah, it's called a winding up problem, and they really don't have an explanation for it.
They're groping in the dark, and they hope that dark matter and dark energy, they hope that the universe is pretty much filled with things we can't see, which explain all the overwhelming evidence that refutes their Big Bang theory.
That's right. Well, this article, it's called Oddly Young Galaxies, and it talks about the amount of metals, elements heavier than helium. They're not finding as many as they'd expect if these guys are 13 billion years old.
Right. Now, this story about young galaxies, the galaxies, there should be old galaxies out there. If the universe is 14 billion years old, there should be old galaxies too, but they said, well, what's going on? They're so young, and we're getting this. Of course, there's an article in Creation Magazine, but they get it from space.com. Fred, space.com, is that a Christian ministry?
I have a feeling it isn't.
No, space.com is a Darwinian evolutionary Big Bang news source for astronomy news, space.com, and they quote Indiana University astronomer John Salzer, and he's talking about this problem of galaxies, that the galaxies are too young. And he says, we're not saying there's a complete breakdown in the theory of galaxy evolution, but these objects do run counter to the standard model.
There's another surprise, surprise, surprise.
So everything they look at runs counter to what they expect, everything. And so it's funny for him to say, we're not saying there's a complete breakdown in the theory of galaxy evolution. You know what, Fred? They don't know how galaxies evolve. They don't know. They want you to think they do. They don't know. And here's my proof, even to an evolutionist, that they don't know how galaxies evolve. The publisher of Nature magazine for 23 years, Tom Maddox, he wrote a book called What Remains to Be Discovered. And in his book, he says flatly that the Big Bang Theory offers no insight into what came first, stars or galaxies. Now, galaxies are made of stars. Stars populate galaxies. If you don't even know what came first, stars or galaxies, you clearly don't know how galaxies formed. You don't know. You just don't know. And the standard model of how stars form, it cheats because it begins when the star is already forming by gravitational attraction. They just cheat. And there's so many problems with just the star forming, because gravity is a weak force, and if gas started to collect, you'd increase the temperature and the pressure, and that would shoot the gas out. Gas doesn't coalesce into balls in outer space.
Yeah, I think stars were created in their place on day four. We've got so much evidence. We talked about the spiral arms. No matter how far out you look with the Hubble telescope, they've got the same spiral arms as if they were just planted there.
You got the same kind. So that is just so much fun. So the galaxies, the spider webs, it points to a creator God.
Bob, the next thing in the creation I wanted to talk about, I thought it was kind of funny. It's a cartoon in here of a guy that's trying to produce life in the lab, you know, that synthesized life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you remember things like the Miller-Urey experiment where he
Miller-Urey?
Came
out. Miller-Urey?
He came up with the amino acids.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
He had all his test tubes and his pipes and his Bunsen burners, and he put in all the right elements. And
he was able to produce some amino acids that are the building blocks for proteins.
Yeah. Now, I think they weren't all left-handed amino acids.
Yeah, they were left and right-handed.
Which life requires.
Yeah, life requires all amino acids to be left-handed. Now, that's a shape. It's a configuration, mm-hmm. and they all come in left-handed. I mean, God, you know, I think he's always thwarting naturalistic explanations.
He is.
When Uri Miller did this experiment, they came up all mixed, as we'd expect, just a random.
And he had to immediately siphon off the amino acids because the same process that created them destroyed them. And he'd add the electricity, and he'd got some amino acids. That's like if you're trying to make a spaceship. And you start out with some rocks. Here's some rocks.
Yeah.
Okay, let's launch tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. I can build a shuttle now. I've proven that you can build a shuttle.
Right.
This cartoon said, there's a guy, a scientist, says, if I can just synthesize life here, then I'll have proven that no intelligence was necessary to form life in the beginning. So he's admitting that he's not realizing he's basically saying he's dumb.
Yeah, that's right. So they have laboratories filled with the world's most sophisticated equipment and some of the highest IQ trained technicians, and they're trying to prove that life can start without intelligence. It's so funny. It's, you know, if they say that they're as dumb as apes, Fred, it's a little hard to disagree with that, a little bit. I mean, I got to give it to them. There's some bit of evidence there if they say that they're very similar to apes. So, Fred, how about the octopus? We only have a couple more minutes.
Okay.
The octopus fossils, it's astounding that you can find a fossil of an octopus because they have almost no skeleton. The only hard part of the octopus is his mouth.
That's right. And when an octopus dies, it should turn into a blob pretty quick. I mean, it doesn't take long for it to decompose.
No.
But yet they found an octopus fossilized in limestone.
Five of them. Yeah.
So,
and in limestone, no less.
Limestone. Now, why is limestone important?
That's funny because they say that the limestone, now they're wrong, but they say the limestone forms gradually as it precipitates out of water where like shellfish live. So that would take forever to cover up an octopus.
That's right. So not only is it found in limestone that they claim is millions of years old, it's the octopus is remarkably similar to octopuses today. It's called stasis in the fossil record. It hasn't changed. Well, maybe it hasn't changed because it's buried only maybe, what, 4,000 years ago in a flood.
So they say 95 million years ago, surprise, they're just like a modern octopus.
And five of them.
And they got internal gills they showed from the fossils and even remnants of ink. Remember that 155-million-year-old squid?
Yeah, that's right. They had this 155-million-year-old squid that they got ink out of, and they wrote. They took the ink and they were able to write with it.
They even drew a picture of the squid.
It's amazing how ink could survive that long.
It really is. Yeah, without dehydrating. So, Fred, it's a lot of fun to study God's creation, not being hostile to him, but seeing the glory of his wonderful mind.
That's right. His marvelous things were made to be remembered.
Thank you, Fred Williams. What a joy. Another episode of Real Science Friday. Maranatha Christian Center in Arvada. What a great school. And our website is kgov.com. Please help out. May God bless you.